So, welcome to today's deep dive. I was thinking about this, and in early 2022, European leaders were they were utterly convinced that a large-scale land war was physically impossible.
Right, because of the economies.
Exactly. I mean, their economies were completely wired to Russia's. We're talking thousands of miles of natural gas pipelines. The whole logic for decades was that this kind of deep economic integration, tying your actual plumbing and electrical grids to your neighbor, was basically the ultimate insurance policy against war.
Yeah, the idea being, you don't bomb the people who are buying your gas.
Right. And you definitely don't invade the people supplying it.
It was a very comfortable, very rational assumption to make. Honestly, the entire post-WWII security order was built on that exact idea, that if capital and goods are crossing borders, armies just won't.
Right up until the morning of February 24th. When, the whole world just watched this massive mechanized invasion force roll straight across those borders. And suddenly those pipelines didn't look like tethers of peace anymore.
No, they look like a loosh.
Exactly, a leash. And that illusion, completely shattering, is what we are digging into today. We're pulling our insights from Chapter 11 of this really comprehensive geopolitical analysis called Dossier Trump 2015-2029.
It's a massive document. Really fascinating stuff.
It really is. And our mission today is to unpack the mechanics of why the 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine wasn't just, a regional border dispute. We want to show you how it functioned as this massive geopolitical earthquake that just broke the modern rules of global security and trade and diplomacy.
Yeah, and to really understand the sheer magnitude of that earthquake, you have to look at the structural tensions that built up to it over time. I mean, conflicts of this scale, they don't just spark in a vacuum.
No, of course not.
The dossier outlines how, for nearly two decades, Ukraine and Russia were operating on these two completely incompatible trajectories. I mean, if you look back at Ukraine's Orange Revolution in 2004 and then later the Euromaidan protests in 2014.
Those weren't just spontaneous crowds hanging out in a square.
Exactly. They represented a deep structural, legal, and economic pivot. Ukraine was actively rewriting its institutional DNA, basically, to align with Western legal frameworks and European markets.
And if you're sitting in the Kremlin looking at a map, you're not seeing a neighbor just, optimizing their trade agreement.
No, you're seeing a Western security apparatus absorbing what you consider to be your historical and strategic buffer zone.
Right. Which is why the escalation of violence wasn't actually sudden at all.
Not at all. I mean, the annexation of Crimea in 2014 and the proxy war in the Donbas region, those were physical manifestations of Russia attempting to forcibly stop that institutional pivot. So the clash of visions was hot long before the armored columns ever moved toward Kyiv in 2022.
But let's actually talk about those columns for a second, because the intelligence consensus in the West right before the invasion was, well, it was incredibly pessimistic.
Oh, absolutely. Everyone was doing the math.
Right, they were counting tanks, counting fighter jets, counting artillery barrels. And the prevailing wisdom was just that Kyiv would fall in a matter of days.
Yeah, but the math was completely wrong because they were only measuring hardware. They weren't looking at the underlying operational mechanics of the two forces.
Which is wild to think about now.
It is. The dossier breaks down why the Ukrainian resistance was so stunningly effective, and it really comes down to structural preparation. Since 2014, Ukraine hadn't just been fighting in the Donbas. They had been completely restructuring their military doctrine.
So it wasn't just raw willpower like you see in the movies. It was a totally different operating system.
Exactly that. The Russian military was operating on this very rigid top-down command structure. Like, if a unit on the ground encounters a problem, they literally have to radio up the chain of command, wait for some general miles away to make a decision, and then wait for the order to come back down.
Wow, that's so slow.
Too slow. Meanwhile, Ukraine, which had been heavily influenced by Western training since 2014, had decentralized its command. They empowered their non-commissioned officers.
So that means a Ukrainian lieutenant or a sergeant in the field could just change tactics on the fly without having to ask Kyiv for permission every 5 minutes.
Yes.
It's like everyone expected a 100-meter sprint, but Ukraine showed up completely trained for an ultramarathon. Or like sending a swarm of autonomous drones against this rigid, heavily armored train moving on a single track. As long as the swarm stays mobile, the train's massive size actually becomes a liability.
That's a great analogy. And the flexibility of that decentralized command was amplified by this massive, unprecedented national mobilization. You had everyday civilians integrating into the defense apparatus in real time.
Like using their smartphones for intelligence gathering.
Exactly. Handling logistics, territorial defense, everything. It forced a total paradigm shift. The invasion transformed from a rapid decapitation strike into this grueling, high-intensity war of attrition.
Which bought the rest of the world the most valuable commodity in any crisis, which is time. Because Ukraine held the line, the West actually had the window they needed to organize a response.
Right, and we need to talk about that response.
Yeah, let's look under the hood there. Because supplying a war zone of this magnitude isn't just about, you know, dropping off a few crates of rifles. The logistics are staggering.
Oh, it required building a shadow logistical empire almost overnight. Almost immediately, this massive international coalition had to figure out how to physically move heavy armor, air defense systems, and literally millions of rounds of ammunition into a country under active bombardment.
And Poland essentially became the funnel for all of that, right?
Yes, Poland was critical. But the military hardware was only one piece of what the dossier calls a three-pronged support structure.
Right, because if you're fighting a war, your economy is effectively paralyzed, tax revenue just plummets, businesses close, but you still have to pay your soldiers, you still have to pay pensions, keep the hospitals running.
Keep the electrical grid from collapsing. Because if the state goes bankrupt, the front line collapses regardless of how many tanks you have. So the second prong was this massive economic intervention. The coalition had to inject direct budget support just to keep the Ukrainian government solvent.
Wow. And the third prong?
The third was the immediate, staggering humanitarian effort. We're talking about absorbing millions of refugees across European borders while simultaneously pumping medical supplies and emergency infrastructure back into Ukraine.
Okay, but supplying Ukraine was only half the strategy. The other half was targeting Russia directly through economic warfare. And I want to push back on this a bit because politicians always love standing at podiums and announcing these sweeping sanctions, right?
Yeah.
Claiming they're going to cripple the enemy's war machine.
Sounds good on TV.
Right. But if you look at the actual macroeconomic data, Russia's economy didn't implode in 2022. We always hear about sanctions. But did they actually work as a magic wand, or did they just force Russia to find new customers? Like, didn't they just pivot to selling massive quantities of oil and gas to India and China?
Well, we are entirely measuring it the wrong way if we expect sanctions to be a magic wand that instantly stops tanks in their tracks. Sanctions in modern warfare act a lot more like rust.
Rust. Okay, how so?
So the headline measures targeted the major Russian banks, and they froze international transactions, which did cause some immediate shockwaves. But the truly crippling mechanisms, the ones that act like rust, were the technology export controls.
Microchips.
Yes, the microchips. A modern precision-guided missile isn't just a tube of explosives, it's a flying computer. It relies on advanced microchips, sensors, and gyroscopes that are manufactured largely in the West or by Western allies like Taiwan.
Right.
By cutting off Russia's access to those specific high-tech supply chains, the coalition wasn't trying to bankrupt a local grocery store in Moscow. They were intentionally starving the military-industrial complex of the specific components it needs to build advanced hardware.
Oh, I see. So even if Russia has billions of dollars flowing in from oil sales to China, if they literally cannot buy the specific processing chip required for a hypersonic missile's guidance system, that money is effectively useless on the battlefield.
Exactly. And that forces them to scavenge. It forces them to try and rip consumer-grade chips out of washing machines or pay massive, massive premiums to smuggle inferior tech through shadow networks. The real goal of the sanctions was to degrade the future capacity and precision of the Russian military over time.
It's friction. You're pouring sand into the gears of their defense industry.
Precisely.
But the irony here is that while the West was pouring sand into Russia's gears, Europe was realizing his own defense gears were completely rusted shut. The boomerang effect of this war on European security policy is just fascinating.
It really shattered decades of institutional complacency. For a very long time, many European nations operated pretty comfortably under the umbrella of American security guarantees. They enjoyed the so-called peace dividend after the Cold War.
Because large-scale war seemed impossible.
Right. So defense spending was treated as a discretionary budget. It was easy to cut when you needed capital for domestic programs. Their militaries were essentially optimized for boutique counterinsurgency operations.
Like Afghanistan.
Exactly. They had highly advanced precision gear, but absolutely zero depth. So when they suddenly needed to supply Ukraine with, say, 155 millimeter artillery shells, Europe realized they didn't have the manufacturing capacity to produce in a month what was being fired in just a few days.
Because you can't just flip a switch and 3D print an artillery shell. You need specialized chemical supply chains for the explosives, heavy metallurgical tooling for the brass casings, skilled labor. It takes years to spin those production lines back up.
Which forced Europe into a frantic, massive reinvestment in its own military industrial base.
And it fundamentally redrew the geopolitical map. I mean, you have this incredible historical paradox where one of Russia's primary justifications for the invasion was to push NATO back, right? To prevent the alliance from expanding closer to its borders.
And the mechanical result was the exact opposite. By launching the invasion, Russia instantly proved to non-aligned countries that neutrality was just no longer a viable security strategy.
Right. It triggered Finland and Sweden.
Exactly. They abandoned decades of neutrality and joined NATO, which practically doubled the length of Russia's direct land border with the alliance. It was a spectacular strategic backfire.
But the scramble to rearm was really only the second biggest panic in Europe. Let's talk about the energy grid.
Yeah.
Because for you, the listener, this is where geopolitics actually hits your thermostat. For years, European industry, particularly in Germany, relied heavily on the steady flow of cheap Russian natural gas.
The pipeline illusion we talked about at the beginning, Europe had effectively outsourced a critical pillar of its national security to a systemic rival.
Which is insane in hindsight.
It is. So when the war started, energy was instantly weaponized. Europe realized they couldn't just slowly transition away from Russian gas over a decade. They had to do it before the winter set in.
It's like realizing the landlord who controls the thermostat to your house is actively trying to break down your front door. You don't just change the locks. You have to build an entirely new heating system from scratch.
That's exactly what it was like. You can't just decide to suddenly buy liquefied natural gas, LNG, from the United States or Qatar instead. You have to physically have the port infrastructure to receive these massive specialized ships, convert the liquid back into a gas, and then pump it into your grid.
And typically, building a specialized terminal for that takes what, years?
Years. You need environmental reviews, heavy engineering, construction. But Germany managed to build and operationalize their first floating storage regasification unit in under 10 months.
Wow.
The continent executed this desperate, hyper-accelerated pivot. They bought up global LNG supplies, fast-tracked renewable energy projects, and fundamentally re-engineered their energy logistics.
But the structural cost of that is permanent, right? Because cheap piped gas is gone. Now European manufacturing has to rely on more expensive shipped energy. That totally changes their global economic competitiveness moving forward.
It does. It shifts energy security from being a purely economic calculation to a core pillar of strategic autonomy. But, you know, to achieve that autonomy, to buy the time, to build those terminals and factories, Europe relied heavily on the United States carrying the lion's share of the immediate military aid to Ukraine.
Which brings us across the Atlantic. Because while Europe is having this huge existential awakening, Washington is the one writing the checks. The sheer volume of American military and financial support was the load-bearing pillar of the Ukrainian resistance.
Oh, without a doubt.
But as the war dragged on from a rapid crisis into this grueling war of attrition, a massive, highly polarized domestic debate erupted in the U.S.
And the dossier details this debate by really looking at the underlying philosophies driving both sides. It's a fundamental clash over America's role in the world. On one side, you have a perspective that's driven by the domino theory of international relations.
The idea that if you allow a nuclear power to redraw borders by force in Europe, you are basically signaling to every other adversarial power on the globe that the rules-based order is dead.
Precisely. This camp argues that supporting Ukraine is a relatively low-cost mechanism to degrade the military capacity of a major geopolitical rival without risking American troops. It's viewed as essential deterrence.
Right. Like, if you don't stop the aggression in Ukraine, you will eventually have to fight a much larger, much more expensive war later on.
Exactly, potentially even defending a NATO ally. But then you have the opposing camp, and their perspective is rooted heavily in domestic priorities and long-term sustainability. They're looking at the billions of dollars flowing out and asking, what is the end game here?
Which is a fair question.
It is. This perspective points to the fatigue of a post-9/11 forever war era. They questioned whether the American taxpayer should underwrite European security indefinitely, especially when the U.S. is facing intense internal economic pressures, infrastructure challenges, and shifting strategic priorities like moving focus toward the Indo-Pacific.
So the core argument there is really about defining strict limits on American international commitments.
Exactly.
Now, if you're a voter in the U.S., this is a pretty standard, albeit intense, foreign policy debate. But if you are a European defense planner, listening to this debate unfold in Congress, I mean, how do you even write a 10-year security strategy when your biggest ally's foreign policy might shift every election cycle? It must be absolutely terrifying.
It introduces a highly volatile variable into your long-term security architecture.
Hmm.
A European defense planner operates on procurement cycles that last a decade or more.
But the bedrock of your strategy might evaporate in 2 to 4 years.
Right. It basically proves to Europe that strategic autonomy isn't just a political buzzword anymore. It's an absolute operational necessity.
But the ripples of this conflict didn't just destabilize the transatlantic relationship. The dossier zooms out to map the truly global shockwaves, which really highlights why this matters even to someone living thousands of miles away from Kyiv. This wasn't just a European war. It was a systemic stress test of the globalized economy.
Because Ukraine and Russia aren't just lines on a map. They are the global breadbasket and the global gas station.
Right.
When two massive exporters of baseline commodities go to war, the entire planet feels the supply chain snap. Let's just look at the mechanics of the agricultural shock. Ukraine is one of the world's largest exporters of wheat, corn, and sunflower oil.
Stuff everyone needs.
Yeah. And when Russia blockaded and mined the Black Sea ports, it wasn't just that ships couldn't physically leave. It was that maritime insurance companies immediately refused to insure any vessels entering a war zone.
And if a commercial ship can't get insurance, it just doesn't sail.
It doesn't sail. And if the ships don't sail, millions of tons of grain just sit rotting in silos. The global supply of baseline caloric staples plummeted overnight. Combine that with massive disruptions to Russian fertilizer exports, and you saw food prices skyrocket globally.
Which placed immediate crushing pressure on developing nations, particularly places in North Africa and the Middle East that rely heavily on those specific imports for basic food security.
Exactly. So a naval blockade in the Black Sea physically threatens the stability of governments in Egypt or Lebanon because suddenly they can't subsidize the price of bread. It really shows how fragile our interconnected system actually is.
And the historians in the dossier place this systemic shock into a very specific context, right? They compare the 2022 invasion to defining watershed years like 1914, 1939, and 1989.
Yeah. Now, the mechanics of each of those eras are obviously different, but they share a core characteristic. They mark the definitive collapse of the existing international rulebook.
Because the post-1945 order was built on the idea of multilateralism. We created the United Nations, the World Trade Organization. The collective theory was that international institutions and deeply intertwined economies could successfully deter raw territorial conquest.
But the invasion fundamentally proved that the security order is not the default state of nature. It doesn't just maintain itself because we signed a few treaties.
Right. The old order assumed that large-scale conflict was economically irrational, and therefore it was impossible.
But the new reality is that some states are willing to absorb catastrophic economic damage to achieve geopolitical and historical objectives.
Which poses the ultimate question of this chapter, and really the whole dossier.
Yeah.
Was this just a temporary, chaotic transition period? Or is 2022 the definitive dawn of a new, harder world order where power, security alliances, and resource control completely override economic integration?
The dossier concludes we are firmly in the latter. The baseline assumptions of the 21st century have been violently rewritten. We are entering an era of intense, prolonged geopolitical competition where the international system is actively fracturing and reorganizing into completely new blocks.
And that reorganization, those new blocks forming out of the fractures, is exactly what Chapter 12 of the dossier tackles. Looking ahead to our next deep dive, we're going to explore the era from 2015 to 2029, through the lens of the declining unipolar moment. The United States' era of undisputed global dominance is being actively challenged.
It's going to be a really fascinating breakdown. We'll be analyzing the mechanics of a truly multipolar world. We'll look at China leveraging its massive industrial base for strategic leverage, India walking this fiercely independent tightrope between East and West.
And critically, the aggressive expansion of the BRICS nations, right?
Yeah.
Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa.
Yes. Because they aren't just a political club anymore. They're actively exploring the financial mechanics of de-dollarization. They're trying to build alternative financial systems that bypass the United States' control over global banking.
The geopolitical chessboard is basically being flipped, and the rules are being rewritten in real time. We'll unpack all of the mechanics of that shift in the next deep dive. But for today, we want to leave you with a thought to mull over, circling back to that pipeline leash we started with.
Mm-hmm.
For 50 years, the smartest people in the room promised us that commerce was the ultimate peacemaker. They told us that if we just traded enough microchips and natural gas and wheat, war would become obsolete.
Yeah.
But February 2022 proved that the glue of commerce is incredibly fragile. It washes away the exact second a nation decides its history is more important than its economy. So if money and trade and intertwined supply chains do not actually guarantee peace in the 21st century, well, what does?
It is the single most important question of our time.
It really is. Thank you for joining us today. Keep questioning the mechanics of the world around you, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.